Welcome to my Soul Series. Soul Series is part of Oprah and Friends, exclusively on XM Radio Channel 156. And you can listen to the entire Soul Series collection on xmradio.com/Oprah. It's uplifting, enlightening, truly powerful. Welcome to Soul Series.
All right. Hi, everybody. It's Oprah again. Of course, it's Oprah. It's the Oprah show. So that's who would be hosting it here on the Soul Series. Joined again this week by Dr. Larry Dossey, who is, as I said last week, one of the most seminal thinkers of our time. He's a genius when it comes to prayer and a lot of other things. A physician of internal medicine, best-selling author, many books, Be Careful What You Pray For, Healing Words. It's the definitive book on prayer and the power of prayer in medicine that he wrote 15 years ago. His most recent book that we're going to be talking about today is The Extraordinary Healing Power of Ordinary Things. Last week, we were talking about that Einstein quote about understanding fundamentally whether or knowing the most important question is whether or not the universe is friendly. And that just changes everything. If you believe that the world is there for to be compassionate and to support you in your journey, or you believe that it's everything's working against you, that's the difference between succeeding and not, isn't it, Larry?
Well, I think so. You know, when I first began to explore those prayer experiments, I never thought it would lead in the direction of looking at the universe in a new way. But it does, because
you were traditional medicine. For the most part?
Yes, yeah. I was. And I bought into this idea that, you know, the major players in medicine were drugs and surgical procedures. And it came as a shock to me to discover what I eventually began to consider the best-kept secret in medical research.
That's exactly. It said on the first book, the best-kept secrets in medical science, prayer
and
heals.
Who knew? I didn't. I mean, this was a well-kept secret in my medical
How did you
education.
Discover it? Share with our listeners how you discovered that for yourself.
Someone sent me a copy of an outrageous study in which a cardiologist attempted to study prayer in a coronary care unit the same way you would study the effects of a new medication. You have a bunch of people with a common disease, in this case, heart attack. You give half of them something and not the other half, which is the control group, and then you just compare how they do. Well, in this particular study, it wasn't a drug that was being tested. This radical cardiologist, Dr. Randolph Bird, decided to use prayer as the intervention. Randomized, double-blind study. Doctors, nurses, and patients didn't know who was getting the stuff and who wasn't. And then he just simply looked at the outcomes. And the prayed-for group, not knowing they were being prayed for, did better on many clinical criteria than the people in the control group. I was stunned. I knew
and everything else was equal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And this was just like a dagger in my heart. I looked at this study and I said, Larry, if this study is correct, then the world just changed for you. You're not praying for your patients. And at that time, I wasn't praying for my patients. I would have prayed for them on a bed. I didn't think it was worth anything. And I had patients.
Where were you with religion before then? Did you pray at all? Or was prayer just a perfunctory thing you went through?
I was rebelling.
Okay.
I grew up in the buckle of the Bible Belt and in fundamentalist Christianity,
Texas, Central Texas.
And but I threw away all of that when I went to medical school. And at the time I came across this research, I was certainly not disposed to prayer, believe me. But I knew in a heartbeat that if that study was correct in prayer, really did something therapeutic for people in the coronary care unit, I better reconsider my boycott of prayer. And I did. I spent 3 years looking at all the research that had ever been done in the world and was totally shocked to find it so abundant. And in that time, I began to incorporate prayer in a morning prayer ritual religiously every morning because I knew that I had to in order to do justice to these
in a morning
findings.
Prayer ritual, saying a specific prayer like Our Father?
No, it's almost comical.
Okay.
I couldn't go back to those old rituals that I grew up with, so I invented my own.
Okay.
You know, over the years, I've accumulated shamanic rattles, you know, of a great variety. I have one of the world's greatest supplies of incense.
Wow.
So I would go into my office, lock the door from the inside.
That's right.
And have...
Because you don't want any nurses coming in seeing that.
Nope.
Yeah.
And
you,
I would shake
you
my
You shaking
rattles.
Your rattles.
Exactly.
Yes.
Burning my incense and ritualistically praying for the best outcome for my patients. I did that until I left my practice of internal medicine. So this deeply affected me in the way I...
And would you feel better or what?
I felt terrific because I knew that I was taking a more holistic and complete approach to therapy than by just using biologically and physicalistically oriented approaches. I thought that was it.
Right.
I had written other
well,
books
if I'm going to have
this,
a surgeon, I want the one that's praying for him before he goes in the room.
Well, yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. And... Then I wrote the book, and I began to get letters from doctors all over the country telling me that their experiences matched mine in terms of their willingness to honor this information and to make it a part of their daily practice.
Now, knowing that data exists proving that prayer has the power to heal, as you documented in Healing Words over 15 years ago, isn't it like malpractice not to practice it then?
Well, you know, that was one of the predictions I made in 1993 in the book, that if the data continues to be strong and more abundant, and if prayer becomes the standard of practice in a given community, and a doctor doesn't at least recommend it to his patients, that doctor could conceivably be considered guilty of malpractice.
Hmm.
I kind of had my tongue in my cheek when I made that prediction,
mm-hmm.
and I have to concede and confess that it has not proved to be true.
Right.
And perhaps it shouldn't, because I think that the main thing doctors ought to do is to use this information in an educational sense mm-hmm. and to inform patients of the power of prayer and then let the patient make up their mind about whether or not they want to incorporate this into their health
strategy. But Dr. Larry Dossa here, let me ask you this. What if those doctors that you're speaking of, what if they are where you were, rebelling? Or just don't believe, haven't read the evidence. What if they are there and their patients, and they're also their patients are there? If they say, pray to what? Pray to whom?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think many of them are in that rebellious mm-hmm. stage of essentially denial
yeah.
that this information is out there. You know, I think that's where patients need to take charge. And if they're... And under the care of a physician who they think is not attuned to their spiritual needs, they need to shop it. And I've advised patients of this for years.
That doesn't mean the doctor has to be of the same religion as you.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yes.
No.
Because prayer works in every religion.
That's one of the great things about these
yeah.
studies.
Yeah.
They point like an arrow to religious tolerance and openness. These studies show that no particular religion has cornered the market on this prayer stuff. And I'm happy about that. That's one of the great contributions that these studies have made, I think, to human welfare, this affirmation of tolerance and openness between faiths.
So this idea of praying every day, when you then started to not just believe the study, research the study, but prove that the studies were correct, did that then lead you to an understanding that there was healing power in ordinary things?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But actually, I began to be fascinated by the healing power of simple things quite early in my life. I had an emergency appendectomy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a terrible experience. I never met the surgeon ahead of time. He just didn't think it was necessary. I didn't meet the anesthesiologist ahead of time. When I woke up, I was in pain. I was alone. I felt isolated, anxious, hurting like crazy. And I had no idea what was found at surgery. No one had bothered to even tell me. And something simple happened. A nurse came by, and she merely held my hand, and she said, "Don't worry, Larry, everything's going to be just fine." And it was like a switch turned in my body and brain. The pain immediately went away. So did the anxiety and fear. And I knew in a heartbeat that something had happened to me that I didn't understand. I had met a healer. At that time, healing was not even in my vocabulary. I didn't know what...
Nor in the psychic consciousness of the country, yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
But that experience of that little simple act of just touch, hand-holding, was seared into my brain and my memory, and it stayed with me ever since. And I sort of developed.
Do you think that she had some special powers, or that the power came in the act, in the actual act itself, that she did it?
I think probably both. Mm-hmm. I think this woman was a healer. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she knew she was a healer or not, but that's what healers do. I mean, this is a classic.
And I think lots of nurses
moment.
Are drawn into this field because they are, but that's not what they call themselves. Healers, they call themselves nurses.
I know.
Yeah.
And Oprah, I got so fired up and carried away with the power of nurses, I married me one. I
mean, that was must have been some
30-something years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love what you say in the extraordinary healing power of ordinary things. And you're right. It's about, you know, all the ordinary things like optimism and forgetting and tears and dirt and bugs. In the end, you say, when you write about optimism, it will not be weekend conferences or seminars or web-based courses or books that will teach people how to be optimistic. Rather, it will be what we do as a nation to create the conditions in which optimism can flower.
I feel so strongly about this.
I do too.
I think that one of the failings of the integrative, complementary, alternative healthcare movement has been that we have not been attuned to the social conditions that promote either illness or health. And I think that we as a nation are in the process, hopefully, as we enter this election cycle, of paying more attention to that. We've got to do more than preach the virtues of acupuncture and homeopathy and diet and exercise, because if people are burdened by not having adequate nutrition, even a roof over their head, and so I think it's hypocritical for us as professionals to talk about these other things without doing what we can to help people get their basic needs met. And let's not kid ourselves. That's a huge issue in America currently.
Getting your basic needs met still.
Exactly. Those primary basic needs that have to do with whether or not somebody goes to bed hungry at night, for example, or whether they're able to finish high school. Unless we pay attention to these things, these add-ons just aren't going to carry that much weight for those people.
How is their healing power in dirt?
Dirt's back, let me tell you. if you look at children who are exposed to unhygienic conditions growing up, these kids turn out to have a more robust immune system later in life than children whose mothers throughout their upbringing try to keep them squeaky clean 24/7. Mm-hmm. They have a lower incidence of childhood asthma if they're raised in dirty environments. They have a lower incidence of infectious diseases and allergies.
I thought it was the opposite.
Well, I know. Everybody thinks this. The data do not say this, however. There's something now that has brought this to the fore. It's called the hygiene hypothesis. In a nutshell, it says that during our formative years, children need exposure to the bacteria, viruses, and fungi that are in dirt, common dirt. It challenges the immune system to develop antibodies that will protect you the rest of your life. If you look at kids who are raised on farms, for example, they do much better in terms of immune function later in life than kids who are raised in hygienic environments. And so the recommendations now from authorities who look at this field is that parents consider exposing their kids purposefully to dirty experiences, playing in sandboxes, for example, which has sort of gone out of style.
Right.
You know, making mud pies.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite is just simply gardening. In garden soil, you have all the microbes that one needs to boost the immune system in these very important ways. And so we're not talking about, you know, not taking showers or anything like that. We're talking about deliberate exposure to the outdoors in ways that are increasingly out of style, in particular in urban environments.
Yeah, that's why you mentioned bugs, too, because people are sort of, talk about what you say in the book about bugs, where people associate bugs with, you know, everything to do with being out there in nature and trying to remove yourself from that instead of connecting to it.
Well, the most dramatic example of the reappearance of bugs, by which I mean just creepy crawlies in general, is the use of leeches and maggots and modern surgery. There are situations now where doctors are deliberately applying maggots to infected wounds to clean them up in cases of diabetic ulcerations, in cases where wounds will not heal because the...
Is this in places in the world where there's no antibiotics?
Exactly. Third world countries really are embracing this return of maggots and leeches in medical and surgical situations. So,
Are you saying that's a good thing, Larry?
That's a wonderful thing. Let me tell you something.
I was reading this, I'm thinking, are you now saying bugs are a good thing? Yes.
Bugs are good.
Larry, that's a little out there for me, I got to tell you.
Well, that's why that these, you know, this is an outrageous idea, I'd be the first to admit. But that's one of the criteria I had for selecting a topic for these chapters. Mm-hmm. It had to be outrageous. Mm-hmm. It had to shake you up. And certainly the use of maggots, as is being done now in hospitals across the United States, shakes people up because we're repelled by that idea. It's been bred into us that we don't want anything to do with
this. No, we don't. But Did you just say maggots are being used in hospitals across the United States?
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you an example. Everybody's heard about methicillin-resistant staph.
I thought that's what you said.
In our hospitals.
You have seen them, these maggots?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Okay. There are situations where nothing else will work as well. Maggots will not eat healthy tissue. They will debride dead and dying tissue in a wound where nothing else will work.
There are patients in these United States.
Yes.
Do they know that they're maggots?
Oh, yes, they do. These usually are people who have flunked therapy from almost everything else. They're at the end of the line. And I'll tell you, if you are facing either amputation of your foot from a diabetic ulcer, are the recommendations that we apply some maggots and let them clean up the wound and let it heal naturally. I think most people would choose the maggot therapy rather than have their foot amputated. These are real-life examples. I think most people... even though they're repelled by this, would make that choice in favor of this outrageous therapy.
Well, you know, you're talking about the power of ordinary things and simple things. You know, all of us who have experienced hearing a beautiful song sometimes can often feel the words of that song and the melody and the harmony come together in such a way that make you feel healed.
There's a chapter on music, and I present cases in there that are almost... unthinkable. They border on the miraculous. For example, patients have been deeply comatose in neurological intensive care units from injuries, and they respond not at all to verbal stimuli and so on. And in many of these cases, there are about a dozen now on record. Christmas comes around, the carolers come into the neurological intensive care unit, and they sing these songs. And the person wakes up. There's something about the power of the Christmas carol in particular to stir memories that are really pleasant, and they're practically miraculous. These patients will start trying to extubate themselves, taking out their breathing tube. In many cases, they start yanking out their IVs, and they wake up. And in one case I talk about in the book, the guy wakes up from coma, joins in singing, "Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Yes.
The nurses start weeping. They've never seen anything like this before.
And what is it? Is it because of what the music represents or the actual, vibrational, tonal thing of the songs? What is it?
The going idea is that even in coma, the auditory sense never goes totally away. So the song gets through to deep parts of the brain and triggers memories. Most of us...
It's about memories. Is it not about Jesus? It's about memories.
It's about... Well, we really don't know. But I think it has to do with exceedingly pleasant memories that we build up in store as children growing up.
Okay.
And those get triggered, and that stimulus does something to awaken the person. This is so profound, Oprah, that I've given standing instructions to my wife that if I'm ever in an auto accident, get carried off to the neurological intensive care unit, you know, get me the best neurosurgeon you can, but get those carolers in there and have them
bring in there. Tell me this. What heals you other than that nurse?
Oh, wow. I get my greatest sense of healing from doing my work and knowing that I'm on the path, the right path. And when I'm doing my work and standing up for what I think is right, in spite of criticism and what people think, that's the most healing thing for me. It really is transformative. My life does not work well when I do not do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've developed a very sensitive awareness of when I depart from that path and when
Does that happen as we get older, Larry, that we are more attuned?
You know, as we get older, I find that I have a different attitude toward this idea of happiness also. Mm-hmm. And I write about this in the book. There are a couple of ways of dealing with that. One is to get out of sorts about the fact that you're unhappy and you're suffering, which just sort of intensifies it. The other is to back off and take the position that's advocated in mindfulness meditation, where mm-hmm. you just simply observe it.
I will say this, that you are the fifth show that I've done today, and I never felt more alive or alert. And that was worth the wait to be able to talk to you.
That's so kind of you.
Yes, really.
I feel the same way, even though this is my first show today.
This is the first show. You're my fifth one today. Happy to have you here joining us again. Larry Dossey, Dr. Larry Dossey. His latest book is The Extraordinary Healing Power of Ordinary Things. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of our Soul Series. These are some of my favorite conversations.
To hear more, sign up for a free 30-day XM Radio trial by going to www.xmradio.com/Oprah.